This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this issue, we talk to Baba Harihar Ramji, founder of the Sonoma Ashram.
What is our greatest fear? Fear of death? Go near it.
Mr. Harry and Mrs. Vivian Schneider, experienced practitioners and teachers of Vipassana meditation.
We're not reacting to the chocolate cake. We're reacting to the feeling we get when we think about it or see it.
And Ms. Birgit Bucher, television film editor and yoga teacher, about her approach to the habit patterns of her mind.
I am not only my emotions or my patterns.
First, some medical news. New York Governor Patterson has called for an 18% tax on sugary sodas and juice drinks. The quote-unquote obesity tax, as it is called, would be on top of existing sales taxes and would apply to non-diet sodas and fruit drinks containing less than 70% natural fruit juice. This tax would bring in an estimated $400 million. Lieutenants of the governor state the tax is an effort to help counter the obesity epidemic. Opponents are asking, why not also place a tax on fast foods, donuts, ice creams, pies, pastries, and candies? Governments have been imposing taxes on activities and substances that are habitual and addictive, such as cigarettes, alcohol, and gambling. These taxes are actually a great source of income for the government, and if the taxes were to have a significant impact on the behavior, the governments would lose hundreds of millions of dollars each year. While Governor Patterson is proposing this heavy tax on sugared beverages with the intention of improving the health of the public, he is also expanding opportunities for people to use alcohol by allowing grocery stores and drug stores to sell wine. The governor is also proposing to increase the number of outlets that sell state lottery tickets, and he plans to install hundreds of video slot machines at a racetrack. It is no coincidence that it is generally poor people who spend disproportionately on cigarettes, alcohol, sodas, and lottery tickets. Andrea Batista Schlesinger, executive director of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, a liberal but nonpartisan research center in New York, said in an interview with the New York Times, "These are habits that are more common among those who have the least amount of political power. To do something in the most politically efficient way is to tax or hike the fees of those who have the least power." A group from the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine published an article in the September issue of Drug and Alcohol Dependence, urging warning labels on supercaffeinated drinks such as Red Bull. Since the introduction of Red Bull in Austria in 1987 and in the United States in 1997, the energy drink market has grown exponentially. Hundreds of different brands are now marketed, with caffeine contents ranging from 50 milligrams to 500 milligrams. A regular 12-ounce cola has about 35 milligrams of caffeine, and a 6-ounce cup of brewed coffee has anywhere between 80 to 150 milligrams of caffeine. Some energy drinks contain the caffeine equivalent of 14 cans of cola. The regulation of energy drinks, including labeling and health warnings, differs across countries, with some of the most lax regulatory requirements in the U.S. The absence of regulatory oversight has resulted in aggressive marketing of energy drinks, primarily towards young men, for psychoactive, performance-enhancing, and stimulant drug effects. There are increasing reports of caffeine intoxication from energy drinks, and it seems likely that problems with caffeine dependence and withdrawal will also be on the rise. In children and adolescents who are not habitual caffeine users, vulnerability to caffeine intoxication may be significantly increased due to an absence of tolerance. Genetic factors may also contribute to an individual's vulnerability to caffeine-related disorders, including caffeine intoxication, dependence, and withdrawal. The combined use of caffeine and alcohol is increasing sharply, and studies suggest that such combined use may increase the rate of alcohol-related injury. Several studies suggest that energy drinks may serve as a gateway to other forms of drug dependence. Regulatory implications concerning labeling and advertising and the clinical implications for children and adolescents are discussed in the paper. Caffeine intoxication is a recognized clinical syndrome marked by nervousness, anxiety, restlessness, insomnia, gastrointestinal upset, tremors, rapid heartbeats, restlessness, and pacing, and in rare cases, even death. The article offers results from a 2007 survey of about 500 college students, in which about half of them reported consuming at least one energy drink during the last month. Of these energy drink users, about 30% reported weekly jolt and crash episodes, and about 20% reported heart palpitations from drinking energy drinks. This same survey found that about 30% of the students said they mixed energy drinks and alcohol at least once in the past month. The researchers are currently collecting case reports of intoxication from energy drinks in children and adolescents. For more information, you can go to www.bpru.org. And the caffeine content of various beverages can be found at www.energyfiend.com. Baba Harihar Ramji founded the Sonoma Oghoreshwar Ashram in 1990. Babaji resides at the ashram most of the year, and I spoke to him there about the Aghora perspective on habits and addictions. Baba Harihar Ramji, thank you so much for offering me this interview.
Sure, you're welcome.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the Aghora tradition is?
Aghora really means that which is not difficult. A means not, ghor means difficult. Aghora is your natural state of being. The basic teaching is you are boundless, you are whole unto yourself, you are complete unto yourself. You are divine. You are not separate from God.
I've read some things about the Aghora tradition that talk about the use of drugs and alcohol as a means to spiritual growth and progress.
It's not really a means to spiritual growth. If you truly understand that you are whole, you are complete, anything that limits you, you have to look at it. So in olden days, the practitioners of Aghora did use intoxicants to just test themselves, that when they took it, was their state of consciousness altered because of it?
Can you explain that a little further? What do you mean? I mean, usually when you take an intoxicant, your state of consciousness will be altered.
If you're a normal human being, but if you're a practicing Aghora, then it does not change. The real practitioners. There are many fake Aghora practitioners who take intoxicants in the name of that I am a Aghora practitioner, but the real practitioners took it just to test themselves if it was altering their state of consciousness. And I have seen many that it did not make any difference.
What makes an Aghora practitioner not a normal human being in terms of how an intoxicant would affect them?
I'm sure you have read stories like Ramdas talks about his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, who took pills of LSD and just didn't make any difference to him. So there are yogis who are established so much into themselves that nothing can shake their state of consciousness.
How do you do that?
How does it happen? How does it happen? I can't tell you. But the only thing I can tell you, when you are truly established in yourself, whatever is inside is outside. When you are in connection with the wholeness, your state of consciousness does not change by anything from outside. That was the old school. But the way Aghora is practiced today, let's look at things that we feel limited by our emotions. When you are angry, you are jealous, you are hurt, you feel limited. So the real practice of Aghora today is looking at our limitations. And if you look at your limitations, you recognize that how much energy you are putting into it. you are angry at someone, how many times you are thinking about them, how much energy you are putting into it. So in today's Aghor practice, we free that energy that we are investing in, that limitation. And that energy is used for betterment of the self, betterment of the society.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
How do you free that? First, you have to look at what do you identify with. Are you identifying with being a victim, or you are identifying with the wholeness that you are? So if you identify with the wholeness that you are, it's easy to let go of those limitations.
So in some ways, this being whole is protective. This is what I'm hearing.
You can say that, but once you are whole and you are identifying with the wholeness, you don't go in a place where you feel hurt or you feel limited.
But I'm going to take this back to drugs and alcohol and habits and addictions. Mm-hmm. And so when you're feeling whole, or when you have developed this wholeness, then anything that would defeat your wholeness would not penetrate. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, let's look at the addiction. What is addiction? Addiction is really trying to fill some kind of emptiness within and using something from outside to fill that emptiness. Now, let's look at a practice. We are whole. But if we look at our daily life, what am I doing to connect with that wholeness daily? Any effort that we make to connect with that wholeness can be called a spiritual practice. What do you do every day in the name of that wholeness? This is one question every individual has to ask himself or herself. Whether you sit and meditate, you chant mantras, you read scriptures, or you stand on one leg and gaze at the sun, or beat a drum and dance around in circle. It doesn't matter what you do. What matters is you do something daily in the name of that wholeness.
How does an Aghor practitioner develop this wholeness that fortifies an Aghor practitioner against the effects of an intoxicant?
We are constantly looking at ourself. At any given moment, what am I identifying with? And you are very vigilant of every moment. I do not take any intoxicant. I do not use any drugs, and neither anybody in this ashram or in this practice. What we have done, this new school of Aghor, we look at that moment when I'm feeling limited, when I'm under the influence of fear, when I'm under the influence of greed, when I'm under the influence of jealousy. I look at, in that very moment, stop, take a step back, take a deep breath, and look at yourself. What are you identifying with in this given moment? That's a practice in itself.
That's beautiful.
Well, you can't do it all the time, but if there are 100 instances in a day, maybe you'll remember 2 times, 3 times, but slowly, slowly, 1 step at a time.
The reputation of the Aghor tradition as using alcohol and intoxicants is, you're saying it's a thing of the past, and that it wasn't really something used for progressing on the path, but something to test their stage in the path.
Exactly. Look at, if you read about Aghor, they would go to the cremation grounds. Now, what is our greatest fear? Fear of death. Go near it. In the cremation ground, you see people coming from all walks of life, old, young, pretty, ugly, rich, poor. So you go there and sit and watch this. Pretty soon you find this coming in you, that this body is transient. There is nothing really to hold on to. So what's the big deal? So in Aghor, whatever you are afraid of, whatever you are repulsed by, whatever you are challenged by, instead of running away from it, you go near it. The analogy is looking at the rope in the darkness. When you see the rope in the darkness, you think it's a snake. You can run. But in Aghor, we're taught, go closer to it. Stand. Watch. Throw a little light on it. If it still doesn't move, maybe use a stick to move it a little bit. Then you know what it is, whether it's a rope or it's a snake.
So the idea is to come closer to a thing that you perceive as harmful in order to strengthen your own inner sense of security so that something else cannot harm you.
Yes. Actually, what you find when you come closer to that, this thing is not going to affect you that much. Even look at the addiction. People take drugs, but what is the state of mind? Are they dependent on it, or they can take it recreationally? And I have nothing against it if they take it once in a while just to check themselves out. But the day you begin to feel that you can't live without it or you have to have it, then that should be avoided.
Are there practitioners who are testing themselves all the time?
There are many. That's why there are many people in India you will see, even I see on National Geographic and the magazines, and who are just posing to be Aghoris, because this gives them a license to
smoke chillum, do ganja.
Yeah, exactly, all those things. But the real practitioners of Aghor are very few. They do not go about exhibiting it. It's an inner work.
Can we make an analogy that it would be like when someone insults you? Because maybe taking an intoxicant is like an insult to your physiology. Someone insults you psychologically, but you are not affected by it. Is that kind of a similar analogy?
Definitely. Because when you are insulted, then you can either feel like a victim, or you can just take a step back, take a deep breath, and acknowledge your wholeness, because this is not going to affect me.
Interesting. Very interesting.
If you are identifying with your wholeness and you are strong enough, you can even watch the moment when you are getting under the influence of intoxicant. You can either flow into it, or you can stop and take a few deep breaths and stretch your body a little bit. You will see that intoxicant does not take hold on you as easily.
What are the practices?
It's something I couldn't really share, but most of our practice revolves around breath, that how you are breathing, what is your breathing pattern at any given moment, how to catch hold of yourself is paying attention to the space between the two breaths.
Do you have anything else you could add about what the perspective is of the Aghor tradition about habits and addictions?
The only thing I can say about the real teaching of Aghor is you are whole, you are complete unto yourself. Look at whenever you feel limited by any emotions. Instead of being the victim, take the higher road.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, JC.
Baba Harihar Ramji, founder of the Sonoma Aghoreshwar Ashram. Da din din da. Da din da tete gena tuna da tete gena tuna tete gena tuna kata gain da da kata gain da da kata gain da. Mr. Harry and Mrs. Vivian Schneider are experienced meditators and teachers of Vipassana meditation. I spoke to them about the relationship between Vipassana meditation and habits and addictions. Vivian and Harry Schneider, thank you so much for meeting with me today.
Thank you. We're happy to be doing this with you, JC.
Can you tell me a little bit about the relationship between meditation and habits and addictions?
Well, meditation is a way of removing addiction, lessening addiction, perhaps eliminating it, and perhaps encouraging behavior you do want instead.
Can you explain how that works?
It works because an addiction is an action we take even though we don't want to sometimes. And it doesn't have to be a negative addiction like we think of drugs or alcohol. It could also be to food, to work, to exercise. But we set ourselves a goal of perhaps lessening that activity and do it anyway, and then afterwards say, oh gosh, there I go again. And that's because we're impelled to do it by a feeling that we have in our body that I want more of that sensation that I had, that experience I had after I exercised or when I exercised. If you can learn to be in touch with that sensation, you don't have to react to it. You can just be with it and not repeat the same action that you find to be something you want to cut down on.
I think of addiction as being a continuum. I think we're all addicted. Certainly we're all addicted to sensations and to our reaction to sensations. Of course, when we're dealing with crime and drugs and alcohol, it becomes very severe and significant. But it's not different than what we all experience all the time, which is feeling sensations, wanting more, craving for them, and taking an action that causes more of that.
There are Vipassana meditation courses conducted in prisons on some occasions. And at one course, there was a prisoner at the end of the course who said, I've always been a street warrior. I've been a tough guy. I've been able to make it out on the street because of my size and my strength. And he said, it hasn't helped me. But after this meditation course, I learned that if I can sit and observe an itch and not react to it, I don't have to react to anger. And therefore, I can improve my life. I thought that was a good way to put it.
That's a very powerful statement.
Yes, absolutely.
What is the relationship between sensations and meditation and habits?
That's really the essence of what the Vipassana meditation is all about. Our understanding is that we're all the time feeling sensations in our body, from the itch that Harry was referring to quite unconscious, very subtle, very nuanced, but they're going on all the time and rapidly. When they become very strong, we react to them, and in an extreme degree, it causes the kind of addictions that people usually think about when they think about a drug or alcohol addiction. The meditation practice, Vipassana, has really three parts. The foundation has to do with a structure of ethics that kind of hold one. Being kind and not harming is really the essence of it. But they're quite specific in terms of not killing, not stealing, not lying, and not using drugs or alcohol. That doesn't mean that this is a shaming practice or a should or a shouldn't, because that really wouldn't help anybody. But knowing that this isn't good for me, and I want to do what's good for me, I want to do what's helpful, it's just kind of a foundation that can be helpful. But then the real way in is the concentration aspect, the samadhi part of the practice, where one works to develop one's concentration, one's focus, and we really work hard at that, bringing the mind back over and over again. Maybe I should say we work softly at that, but continuously, and it's something one can get better at in a few hours, and it's also a lifetime practice. But with the strength of training your mind to come back over and over again to wherever you want it to come to, using the example, one has a huge desire to do something that probably won't be good, which could be a verbal reaction, it could be a physical reaction, it could be going and getting a drink, it could be pushing on at the computer 2 hours more than you'd like to. It could be any one of the things we do every day, or it could be more extreme. With this practice, sooner or later, one becomes aware of what's going on. Taking the time to breathe, taking the time to reflect, and taking the time to feel that impelling craving with the discipline that comes from having train one's mind to concentrate, one can bring one's mind back away from that and say, but I don't have to react. I have choices. It's a combination of understanding what's good for one and not wanting to harm yourself or anyone else, and then building in a real practice through the concentration and furthering that, deepening that with learning to observe sensations and learning to not react as much. To be aware, mindful of one's reactions so that one is not blind. And that's really the essence.
How does concentration of the mind offer you a choice when it comes to a habit?
Well, let's think of an example. There could be so many, many examples, from having the extra piece of chocolate cake to impulsively making a decision to kill somebody or to shoot that heroin. It could be anything. At that moment, one feels, I must do this. I have no choice. But in fact, with reality, we can see that isn't the case. By having developed a little bit of concentration, you're able to have a little control over your mind. And so at that very moment that you have that impulse that I have to do this, I want to do this, I'm going to do that, you also have a little break. It comes from working to discipline the mind, where you realize, I feel like I have to, but do I? Sometimes it's like a car that's speeding, putting the brakes on. It's not one speedy, impulsive continuum. Coming back to your breath, coming back to feeling the sensations, there is a little break. And in that, it can be a momentary break. That's where I make the choice. And the choice can be to do it, the choice can be to not do it.
Interesting. One thing that comes to mind when I listen to you is there are many practices in which one develops concentration. It could be martial arts, or it could be a sport or music, for example. To practice music, you really have to have a very concentrated mind. But we know plenty of musicians who are addicted to substances or addicted to lifestyles that are harmful to them. So what is the difference between the concentration you develop in those practices and the concentration you develop with Vipassana meditation?
Well, it comes from volition. The concentration also helps you be aware of the sensations on your body. And this is really a unique concept, something we should be taught when we're in kindergarten, that we're not reacting to the chocolate cake, we're reacting to the feeling we get when we think about it or see it. And it takes some practice, and it might be something that listeners just can't relate to. But if you stop and slow down and concentrate your mind on where you are and feeling sensations on your body, you will begin to learn that you're reacting to these sensations rather than the object of your attention.
That's a very interesting concept.
If you feel pain and you don't want to react to it, you know it's getting worse and worse. If you can train yourself just to feel the pain and know that it's going to change and wait till it changes, the pain gets less and less because you don't add tension to the pain. You can just feel the sensation of the pain. Now, that doesn't mean you can control all pain, but that's one way we've seen Vipassana work. Another way is with depression. They can feel what it feels like to be depressed, learn that they can just concentrate on that, just feel that, relax with it, as Vivian says, breathe with it, and it gets less and less and less, and they haven't reacted to it, they haven't worried about it, they haven't gotten themselves more depressed.
So it's kind of like you can feel the pain and be okay with the pain. You don't have to take the Vicodin or the heroin or the pain reliever or the ibuprofen or the Tylenol to get rid of it. You just feel it and see what happens.
Yes, but that's so simple to say. I just need to say, we tend to talk about these things as though one just does this and then that happens. Let's take that pain, that extreme pain. One can feel the pain, and up to a certain extent, depending on the pain and depending on the balance of one's mind, and depending on how sensitive one is to the pain and whatever else is going on around, one can then choose. And I think that's really important, to take the Vicodin if they need to, mm-hmm. or not to. You don't get so overwhelmed. It doesn't feel like, oh my God, this is unbearable. You learn that you can bear, but then you can choose. I do want to say that Harry was talking about feelings and sensations, and I think those are really the key to this meditation. Different from concentration, say, from looking at an object or listening to music or
A mantra,
or a hike or a bike ride. Sometimes when we're going off to meditation courses, people say, I meditate too. You know, I do it when I ride my bike. And definitely, we do share an experience. They are relaxing. They are appreciating where they are. Hopefully, they're being mindful. But the key to this particular Vipassana meditation is the sensations, is the feelings. By having a concentrated mind, one then has the ability to feel your feelings, whatever they may be, on the body, as well as the thoughts that appear in the mind, and to have a certain amount of detachment, a certain amount of equanimity, so then you have the choice. But there will be times in all of our lives when we can't help where we are, where we will feel things where the Vicodin isn't available. But we do have to feel mental grief, sadness, loss, harm, hurt, as well as physical pain and other experiences. At those very hard times, it becomes so helpful to have the tool of that concentration, the awareness, and some equanimity with the sensations, with what you're feeling.
What is this word, equanimity?
It means a balance within. It certainly doesn't mean being blah, being a vegetable, having no feelings, no passion, no life, no power. But it does mean having a sense of inner balance, inner peace, inner calm, inner awareness, regardless of what churning is going on inside or outside. The quiet in the eye of the storm, that no matter what all's going around, there's a quiet place inside that you can come back to. And to me, that's equanimity.
That's wonderful. I know my experience has been that I feel like I have a wider range of emotions available to me, that I can feel more of the truth of my feelings and I'm not afraid of them.
And I think some of the not being afraid is that you're familiar with them. they don't hit you with a feeling of, this is going to be more than I can bear. This is something that I should not be experiencing. There's almost a, oh yeah, here it is again. We can learn not to let the feeling of fear scare us. And so learning to experience that anxiety, that terror, that uncomfortable feeling, and to know it, and to know that it is just a feeling, not a fact, to me, that's equanimity.
Beautiful. Well said. It's like accepting your feelings and knowing that pain can't hurt you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Other thing, we've been talking about feelings a lot. And in normal life and world, people think of feelings as emotions. I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling jealous. I'm feeling hungry. But when we talk about it, we talk about feeling what you're actually experiencing as a sensation on your body. And two things happen with that. You begin to identify certain sensations, as is with sadness. You begin to feel, oh, that's what sadness feels like. My whole body is feeling a certain way. And it gives you a signal. Don't react to it. Don't go further into it. Because the second part is, it's going to change. That's the other thing you learn with Vipassana, by sitting and concentrating, that all of your experiences change by themselves without your control. And if you don't react to them, they pass on and you haven't perhaps reacted in another addictive way.
Thank you for clarifying that. You both also conduct courses in prisons. And I can imagine that much of the prison population has experience with addictions, or they may even just have simple habits of stealing cars or stealing things from stores, or habits of lying, habits of getting into trouble. I wonder what your experience has been with that population.
Using the word habit is really a good one, because it's the habit patterns that we all have that we reinforce over and over and over by doing them that turn into the addictions. So yes, in prisons, most of them have at some time or other been addicted to drugs or alcohol, and certainly to behavior and to impulsively reacting, as well as to emotions, addicted to anger, addicted to sadness, addicted to fear, and a feeling of, I can't tolerate this, therefore I must do something, and then doing something that harms them. That's the habit pattern that goes on, and often it goes through families for generations. There is an assumption, which may be different from some other practices, that we don't start off perfectly, that we start off with work to do. All of us, every single one of us, all the time, we actually have work to do, and the work is to develop ourselves to be able to come out of these habit patterns, whatever they might be.
So what have you seen with students of Vipassana that have come through the prison courses?
Tremendous improvement, they would say. There's actually been some statistics, just to talk objectively, there's been some research for the National Institute of Health and the University of Washington, just to sum things up, that there's a 19% decrease in the recidivism rate from the students who practice Vipassana, who took Vipassana courses in the prison, and those who didn't. Much more personally, though, is the reward and the excitement, the wonderfulness that we see from the inmates themselves. They experience joyous improvement. Most of them have never experienced meditation or yoga, or they come in quite open. They respond with working really hard because they know they're suffering. They know they have habit patterns they want to break, and they are earnestly trying to. And they're already living kind of a monastery, so they have lots of opportunity to practice.
I would imagine that although it is somewhat monastic in the prisons, but there's also a lot of crime and violence and drugs within the prisons, and it might be a really difficult place to practice meditation.
There's tremendous crime and drugs and pressures to be a macho dude in the male prisons. Prisoners who've taken meditation courses get teased a lot. Oh, you're going to become a Buddha. You're just going to sit there. You're not going to let anything happen to you, you know. And they have to deal with that. They report that by staying together, by being Dhamma brothers with each other, and by working together, trying to sit together, they can work through that. The prisoners begin to get respect for the program and say, oh, maybe I should take one too. But as Vivian said, they feel joyous, and that again is a sensation on the body, and they learn, oh, I can feel really good if I do things that are helpful to me and helpful to others, and that's a new lesson for them.
That's beautiful. How is taking Vipassana into the prison systems different than people bringing Bible study groups and other religious methods to help people, quote-unquote, reform?
Well, this is offered as an option. We don't say this is going to bring you salvation. This is not a God-centered practice. It's a self-centered practice that you can do this yourself without intercession from anybody else. And there's no shoulds. Prisoners are often very afraid that practicing Vipassana meditation will take them out of their own religion. And they become convinced that, in fact, they'll become better Christians, they'll become better Muslims, they'll become better Hindus, better Jews, by living their religion, because they are not addicted, they're not going with habit patterns. They can choose what they want to do, and they can choose the right actions.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to clarify that. Both of you are very experienced meditators, and you've been teaching courses for a long time. And would you be willing to share one habit or addiction that has been changed in your life through the practice?
In front of each other?
If you dare to.
I consider myself an anxiety specialist. Sometimes in courses when students come up and say they're suffering from anxiety, here you'll just look over at me and say, oh, talk to her. And that's not because I am free of anxiety in my life, but it certainly is no longer the enormous problem and suffering that it had been. That is one area that I can really say I've gotten to know myself better. Seeing how the physical feelings of anxiety make me anxious. The feelings of fear make me scared. And being able to be patient and observe and get to know those feelings without reacting to them, without tying knots and making them more, just being with that, even just a little bit more, has made a tremendous difference in my life, in my outlook on life, in my comfort with myself, and in my being able to think and live more fully.
Seems like feelings of fear are supposed to make you feel scared, and feelings of anxiety are supposed to make you feel nervous. Why not just feel nervous and feel scared?
Yeah, because most of the anxiety and fear that I feel is not anything that's even very real. It's projections, it's future concerns, it's more in the way of worry. I'm not in danger, even though I feel in danger. But I knew that before. Now I know how to work with that feeling of I'm in danger, coming rather quickly to sensations, or to just observing my breath. I find that it's very much diminished.
There are times where fear and anxiety arise, and they may not seem to be founded in any cause. And in those times, you are able to just keep a balanced mind. And then there are times where maybe there is a real cause for fear and anxiety. And does this practice help you to see that more clearly and then to act on that feeling with more clarity?
Yes, yes. Obvious example, if I'm with one of my grandchildren and they start to run in front of a car, I'm not going to stop and observe my feelings. I'm going to see danger, feel danger, and act on it immediately, act on that impulse, that strong, healthy self-preservation and preservation of other impulses. I don't think one becomes passive or oblivious to seeing dangers, taking action, taking sometimes very strong action, and not only dangers, just seeing wrongs, injustices, and acting on that. But that's very different than that gnawing habit pattern, that feeling of unease, feeling of something being wrong when it really isn't. And that's where I have been able to really make progress in that area.
Well, congratulations. That's wonderful. How about for you?
I have lots of different issues that I want to come out of. And one of them is being obsessive, wanting something and not being able to think of anything else, even if it's just a different kind of cheese I want to find in some cheese store or a piece of property that I might be interested in purchasing. I can feel that obsessiveness overpowering me and say, wait a minute, it's just a piece of cheese. I'm making myself crazy. And it might come back, but it comes back a little lighter and a little lighter. And I can say, no, I don't have time to stop for that. And it's not worth it. And I don't want to eat that anyway. And so the obsessiveness has gotten a little lighter. And I can tell when it's starting up and choose whether I want to react to it and say, okay, I'll get it later. Or I'm not going to do it at all. This is really, I don't need it. I don't want it. So I have a choice in terms of how I respond to things I want and not have them turn into obsessions.
Is it always kind of about delayed gratification or denying gratification?
It's not making myself miserable until I can get that cheese. If I get it, fine. If I don't get it, that's okay too. But it's not deferred gratification. It's that I can only do so many things in that hour that I have to shop. If I try to do all of them, I'm going to make myself unhappy and have an unpleasant experience.
How would you say that Vipassana helped you to do that? Because, I mean, you could go to a counselor and they could teach you how to do that.
Well, I don't think so. I think a counselor would say you know what you need to do and you'd think through it intellectually. But at a visceral level, I can feel the obsession.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I have a feeling on my body that makes me feel very compulsive that I'm not going to be, that I'm going to be upset. I feel the feelings that are unpleasant. And I want something to make those feelings go away. And what if I, for example, buy the cheese, those feelings are going to go away and they're going to turn into pleasant feelings. I could talk myself out of a habit as much as I want to. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. It doesn't help. But by paying attention to the sensations, feeling them, they give me a warning. Okay, you have a choice now, Harry. What are you going to do?
That sounds really liberating in a way, like you are the master of your shopping experience.
Yeah, you're the master of all of those things. And I use that as a mild example, because obviously obsessions can be much greater for a car or for more money or for more position or more power.
Reminds me of the book, Who Moved My Cheese?
I didn't read the book. Yes, I see. I know the title.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think lots of things can help break habit patterns, including psychotherapy and counseling, including exercise and yoga, including good friends, all the things that are good for us that we know. I think they all can help. I think certainly an intellectual understanding of what one's doing that one wants to change can help. The problem is it can only help to a certain extent. The beauty of this particular meditation practice of Vipassana has to do with learning to understand and to feel what's going on at that deep, deep level, the deep unconscious level, and then learning to not react to it, learning to be patient with it, understanding that it's a changing phenomena. That's quite different. That really gets to a depth that is profoundly helpful. I don't want in any way to take away from all the tools that are around us. They all fit in and they all have a place.
Well said. Thank you.
No, I just want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for being such dedicated meditators and for teaching courses and serving in the prisons and helping people come out of their habits and addictions. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Mr. Harry and Mrs. Vivian Schneider, teachers of Vipassana meditation. Ms. Birgit Bucher is a television film editor in Germany and a yoga practitioner and teacher. She generously shared with me how she's been approaching the habit patterns of her mind. Birgit, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. Would you be willing to share with us your experiences with habits or addictions or patterns? If there's anything in your life that you would like to change?
Yeah, I don't really have a habit I want to get rid of. It's more about patterns. There are some patterns that come more or less frequently. And sometimes I don't like it when they pop up. So one layer is that, for example, a pattern that if somebody says something positive to me and somebody says something negative, then the positive is, oh yes, uh-huh, and the negative, I will cling on the negative. So it's like working in my mind, and why did she say that? And no. Oh, it's so bad that I have this, and she doesn't like that. And it's really like, yeah, like an addiction to cling to the negative. But on the other hand, I think there is no much use, so this is the other layer maybe, no much use to like fight against a pattern or fight against an addiction, because if I try to fight against it, I will give more energy to it. And so I try to observe what's coming up and try to say, oh yeah, look, here it is again, hello. And also what helps me is after I've seen the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, that they explained it with like chemical reaction, that in your body you really get addicted to this like feeling bad if somebody says something to you you don't like, or your boyfriend doesn't call, and then you feel like, oh, he doesn't love me anymore, and you go really dramatic or pathetic. There is this chemical reaction in the body, and that you really got addicted to it over the years, or I got addicted to it over the years, and this helps me not to take it too serious. Like, oh, it's not the end of the world, there's just something going on. Yeah. And also that I have a feeling I am not only my emotions or my patterns, that there is a part of mine beyond it or beneath or wherever. And this part of emotions or patterns happening, it's just one part of the game.
That's beautifully said. So what I hear is first that you recognize some habits of your mind, the habit, for example, of clinging to a negative experience or reviewing a negative experience in your mind and feeling bad about that negative experience. That is one habit pattern that you have. And that one method you've developed or adopted for dealing with it is to simply recognize it without resisting it and without suppressing it, but just to acknowledge it. My question to you is, has the acknowledgement or the recognition of this habit pattern changed the habit pattern in any way?
So first, sometimes it's not easy just to acknowledge it, because there is often this resistance. Yeah, that's the pattern. And then I'm resisting a little while. And then often there is this point of acknowledgement. And if I can really like feel what it is about, what my emotion is in the moment, like I'm disappointed or I'm feeling sad about somebody saying something to me or whatever it is. Yeah, if I can really feel this emotion, going deeper into that emotion or not resisting the emotion, and then the problem vanishes.
Basically, you are allowing yourself to feel the emotion, allow the emotion to arise and then pass away. And then that experience has been had and is over with, and you're on to the next experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then it's over and then the next is coming. And maybe there is a similar situation coming back like this. And if I'm not really over with it, if it's not done, then of course it will come back. So, okay, then it's time to look at it for the next time.
So you keep feeling it until you're done feeling it?
Yes, I do. I think there's nothing else I could do.
That sounds like actually a very rich way to live your life experience by experience.
Yeah, it is. It's sometimes also not so easy, because sometimes there are things that hurt or make me sad. But for me, it's the way that gives me the most freedom not to be, addicted to patterns.
The freedom to feel the entire range of whatever you're feeling, whether it's, I mean, you can go ahead and feel sad and feel hurt, and then also go ahead and feel happy and feel light.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you mentioned was this understanding that you have that every experience is simply a chemical reaction within your body. Can you describe a little bit more what the significance of that understanding is for you?
Well, for me, it was just like relief, feeling of release when I heard about it or saw this movie, because I understood that it's not that big drama if something like, oh, my boyfriend left me, oh, now it's the end of the world. And that, of course, it is sad and I am sad and feeling unhappy, etc. But it's also that I have that in mind, that it's like an addiction to negative patterns to go there. It's easier to say, oh, come on, wait a minute, to look exactly before this automatism takes place. It's like a situation happens, it's like pushing your button automatically. If it's a pattern, you do this or that. When the button is pushed, or even shortly before the button is pushed, it's like a way to choose, or I can choose, am I going into that drama, or am I just observing it and feeling what there is to feel? As I said, I'm no physician, I can't really explain it from that point of view, but in the movie it was really funny how it was showed. So it's also giving some lightness. It's not the end of the world, it's just a chemical reaction.
So even when you fall in love, you understand that it's just a chemical reaction, and when you break up, you understand it's just a chemical reaction.
Well, this is a very good question. When I fall in love, then I like falling in love, so I don't want to say to myself, oh, come on, it's just a chemical reaction. I really like falling in love, so I really enjoy it. It's more about dealing with the stuff that is not feeling so common or so comfortable. Then I try to have little methods to deal with it. But when I fall in love, it's more about enjoying. It's not romantic to say, oh, no, come on, it's only a chemical reaction.
This is actually a very important point, because part of why we don't like the things that we're uncomfortable with is because we crave for that chemical reaction of what we deem as pleasant. But in the final analysis, it still means your mind is either running towards something or running away from something, and so it's kind of always running. So that contentment that gives you a balance of mind is still pending.
Yeah, that's true. But I think this is, so part one is the class, how to deal with negative emotions. Part two is the class, how to deal with positive emotions. Yeah, I think that's the next step.
Partly it also is this labeling of positive and negative. And whereas what you described earlier seemed to me to carry less judgment or less evaluation of what are classically considered negative emotions, such as hurt or disappointment or sadness. The way you described it earlier was to accept those experiences as equally or as readily as you might accept more pleasant experiences.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe I'm still addicted to pleasant experiences.
Well, join the club.
Yeah.
Join the human club. Is there anything else you'd like to add about your experience or your process in recognizing your own habits and patterns and how you are going about managing them or changing them?
Yeah, maybe one thing to add, that this deals with all kind of emotions, like so to say positive or so to say negative, that it's faster to feel them and then they are gone and something other comes up. In earlier times, it was more like I was spending more time with one emotion. And now it's really like, okay, this is in the moment and this is to feel and it vanishes and there is the next one. So I like it very much. For me, it's more the feeling to be in the moment, not to hang around with that stuff and be like in a wheel running around.
This brings up the issue of time, because you mentioned that you used to spend more time in a negative emotion. Some people remain so busy that they actually, in essence, don't have time to feel their emotions. There's a way in which the time that you're investing in feeling the emotion is actually time-saving. Can you explain your experience about spending more time in an emotion and less time in an emotion now, and how you take the time to feel what you need to feel?
I think what I try to is just to feel what's coming up, the situations in life, what they bring to me. It's also that I sometimes feel that I run away from an emotion I don't like, but then I know, okay, after a while it's really useless. And then I sit down and feel the feeling. And I think it's also like a priority. For me, it's very important, because this is also an understanding that I have of now, of being in the present. And if there is an emotion in the present, then I have to feel it. It's no use to feel it 2 hours later, because then it's gone.
What happens if you're at work and you quote-unquote don't have the time to feel it?
And then it's more difficult, because then I recognize what I'm feeling, and depends on with whom I'm working, because I'm working with different people. And if I know the person well, then I can at least maybe not talk about the whole stuff, but just say, oh, I'm just feeling a little bit whatever, uncomfortable, just share a part of it that something changed in my feeling. Or maybe I go to the toilet, take some time for myself. And sometimes I will just wait till I come home. And then, of course, it's not so good. And you can't really feel an emotion that was 5 hours ago, feel it in the evening. But like reviewing it or just looking at it, is there something that wants to be felt? For me, it's not so easy on work, because if I don't really trust somebody or have the relationship to that person, I'm not at that point that I will like start to cry if there's somebody sitting next to me that I hardly know and tell him the whole story, what is going on. So I have not really found a solution up to now for that.
Well, it would be nice if the world was more accepting of the entire range of human experience without putting a layer of judgment or evaluation on it. That would make at least emotional freedom more accessible.
Yeah, that would be nice. I think so too, because everybody is trying so like to be controlled and nobody should see your emotions, etc. But on the other hand, it's like written on your forehead, so there is really no use to hide. But this is the way it works up to now, and I have made the experience in little steps. I try to talk about these things that people, that they are open, or that they are not like, oh, you're so stupid, go away, leave me alone with that stuff. It's that they are very like welcoming me. So it's also a matter how much I have the courage to try.
Yes, in today's world, it is an act of courage to feel what you feel and not hide it.
Yeah, that's true.
It's very brave. I really thank you for your honesty and bravery in sharing your experience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Birgit Bircher, television film editor in Germany and yoga teacher. Our concluding poem. This is a test. This is only a test of your equanimity, the balance of your mind, and the integrity and security of your connection to the World Wide Web that we are. This test will be conducted at very frequent intervals throughout your life. The point of this test is not to pass, but to allow it to pass. In the event of a real emergency, these tests will require more patience, more discipline, more acceptance, more forgiveness, more compassion, more valor, more gentleness, more grace than you knew you had. Do not wait for further instructions. Simply add more ballast to the keel of your mind. Nanjing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayshree Chander. Website setup and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by GC Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. gypsyjace.net. You can find us on the web at nanjingnow.org. nijingnow.org. Nanjing Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these programs are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.